Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as a matter of fact, prior to this recording, I had a quick conversation with Paul. And welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thank you.
And so, you know, folks, Paul brought up the fact that he's just kind of, I don't know if he was just trying to be funny or making a comment with a light tone to it, or just basically an observation. But I think there's merit in probably repeating that to share with you. And so Paul's observation was that it just seems like the more people start recognizing what Republic Review is and they do, what it does. As you put it, they're really afraid of this.
Yeah, I just, based on your own experiences and that it's kind of taboo, which is strange to me because we're at a point where we've got a solution that at least ought to be considered open for discussion.
Right.
I mentioned to you offline that I've heard now that Texas, you know, wants to secede. Well, there's another option that no one's even talked about.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Okay? Except us.
Why are they launching out? Why is the Texas legislature not basically promulgating something similar to the Kentucky resolutions, but more apropos, I'll just say what they really need to do is they first need to definitize the Constitution, because that is necessary to lay out the argument to say, federal government, don't even come and talk to us about the Constitution unless this is what you're using. You bring up that annotated Constitution and, you know, it has no place in our states. You may be able to become delusional there in the seat of government and, you know, claim that you have exclusive legislative authority. You do. But none of that in that annotated Constitution is applicable within these states.
Well, I think part of the problem is conditioning into complete and near total ignorance of the Constitution. I don't have any other explanation for it. You know, when I talk to audience, I say, you know, we have got a constitutional crisis in America. And the first one is that you don't know the Constitution. Second is you don't enforce the Constitution, and that our oath-bound public servants are either ignorant of it themselves or in open rebellion to it. And so that's, you know, it's, you know, you dug for this, GR. You've dug for this for years.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are at a point where, you know, the word needs to get out. We need to use every effort to get it out, because I've searched for years also. I haven't found anything far any more effective than what we're reading and what you're doing right here.
Yeah. You know, I want to say something that I think is kind of important, because you know me, if I'm wrong, I need to admit it. And most people won't, you know, as a matter of fact, this is one of those things that kind of skims over everybody's head mm-hmm. when I make a comment. And I have been saying that the Electoral College and the political parties had subverted the Constitution after the Civil War. And that is not correct. Now, when you look through I've got a spreadsheet that actually goes through this, and I went all the way up to the 1888 election, and I realized that the subversion actually happened, or when the two parties actually created primaries and locked out all other challenging parties. Basically, they created a monopoly or a duopoly between these two parties, and that happened in 1852. Now, one of the interesting things that was a part of all of this was the 1864 election, because during, well, actually from 64 and 68 were two elections that were really union only elections. Do you know what I mean?
Sure. That means that the southern states, you're saying, didn't participate.
Most of the southern states did not participate, right? In 68, there were a couple of states that had already ratified the 14th Amendment, but I don't think they had all of them back in. I think there were still a few states that were out. But the 64 election was strictly the Union. And the interesting thing was Lincoln changed the party. In other words, Lincoln, when he ran his second time, he actually wanted to sever himself from the Republican Party.
He did.
He did. And he did sever himself from the Republican Party. And the reason being is everybody else was running as Republicans, but he was nationalist, the Nationalist Union.
Okay.
And because it was about nationalism for him, and he put aside the principles, which is why those who stayed within the Republican Party at that point in time were considered radical Republicans.
Mm.
And you could kind of see how, you know, so here's the question. Why is it that the Republican Party claims that Lincoln was, you know, the guy that restored it when he stepped away from it very quickly? As a matter of fact, if you actually go to the Wikipedia page of the 1864 election, and actually if you look at the presidential process, I believe him and Andrew Johnson became Nationalist Union 2 years into the presidency. In other words, by the time they were running their campaign, they were already changing and shifting gears from the Republican platform. So in other words,
Go ahead. So now I've heard this, and because I've heard it, I've repeated it and haven't looked it up, that Lincoln was a Republican and Johnson was a Democrat. Are you saying that I'm mistaken?
Well, so, yes. Yes. Now, there was a nuance because I believe during the election, if you look, this is when the parties had already began. And actually, Douglas was a Democrat. And so when you look at Johnson was actually favoring. So I actually went through this and I realized that there never has been a true a division between a Republican and a Democrat. there may have been, and as a matter of fact, I've yet to find the proof where we actually had two separate parties, because what ended up happening is if you look in the 40s or after Van Buren, the Whig Party actually won.
Okay.
And they actually, you know, became a dominant party. And those were really the remnants of the Republicans. So they went back and forth. And what ended up happening was, I think the Republican Party, because what Madison and Jefferson created really was a, I'll just say a brand name. The Whigs were, you know, a lightning rod, but they didn't create the brand like the Republicans did.
Yeah, okay.
And so it is apparent that in 1856, this is when the Democrats and the Republicans initiated the primary system to basically narrow down the field to guarantee that they would always dominate. And they actually created tickets in this process. to ensure that there would never be a crossover. So in other words, I said that this happened after the presidential or after the Civil War. It actually preceded the Civil War. So anyway, I this is a part of why counties matter most.
Yeah. So I'm just noticing, I'm under Wikipedia, and 1864 United States presidential election says Abraham Lincoln's party was National Union.
Yep. Well, the union meant not labor union, but the union meant, you know, the United States.
Right, and, right. And that's, but it doesn't say Republican.
That's right.
Okay?
It doesn't.
National Union.
Uh-huh.
And now, here's a name I hadn't heard before. It says his opponent for the Democrat was George B. McClellan.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was, maybe I was thinking the 1860 election.
No, actually, if you look at the 1860 election, you'll find that Johnson was considered a Republican, right?
Okay, I am.
So if you look at the Republican Party candidate gallery, you'll actually find, I believe, Andrew Johnson in here somewhere. Where was Andrew Johnson? Anyway, I don't want to waste a lot of time and create dead air. Andrew Johnson was a senator from Tennessee, and at the time, I believe he was a Republican.
Right.
And so basically, Abraham Lincoln selected him as the vice president candidate. And so the point is that the Electoral College, after, you know, all of these years, went all the way up to 1852. The Electoral College, the people chose their electors.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1856, the party took over and chose the electors.
Not constitutionally, by the way.
Correct.
But they've been doing that ever since.
Correct. And the fact is that they even had primaries to downselect and all of that, basically denying all of these other candidates an opportunity to be in that election and to be availed to that entire general election. And the fact that they actually started getting the nation to pay for a primary election, which was not within the Constitution, just, you know, reeks of how they've corrupted our system.
Well, you know, there also isn't a clause in the Constitution that requires someone to be a member of a particular party, right? I mean, there. In other words, qualifications for president.
Right.
Okay.
There's nowhere in there that a state has to have a certain amount of signatures or a certain level of support to be able to be a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Correct.
I mean, we're only talking about adding a name to a piece of paper.
Sure.
Many of those names would be completely obscured because, you know, I don't know about you, but I've actually met people that really did try to run for president. And I mean, they didn't even get their name on the ballot.
Sure.
But even if they did, they would never have been considered because they just didn't have a campaign backing and all of that.
Well,
so what's the harm? So here's the question. What is the harm with allowing everybody's name to be on that, on the national referendum or on the national ballot for the electors to be able to consider? What's the harm?
I don't know that there is, except that this year, let me show you. This year, there are two things I want to point out here. One, I'm going to look this up, but one of the things that came to mind was, why should a presidential candidate's name be on the ballot at all when we're supposed to be voting for our electors?
Uh-huh.
Okay? That's the constitutional process. But I want to look at how many current candidates for president, because I think there are about 1,000.
Uh-huh. Right. Now, actually, what you'll find is Johnson was a Democrat in 1860. And you'll have to go all the way down underneath the Democratic primary. That's where you see his picture. So it is there. He actually did. And I think that's when they even got more aggressive in locking down the party control over the Electoral College and over the entire process. Because right. What ended up happening was you had Lincoln, a nationalist and not a true Republican, and you had Andrew Johnson, who was a Democrat, and they both ran under the Republican ticket, which in the next election, they both sidestepped the Republican Party.
Wow.
So anyway, folks, we're diving into it. As a matter of fact, Paul, I know you probably heard yesterday's show, but I kind of went through the notes on nullification rather quickly. And as we already know, you have some questions. So let's start this off, because I think I covered like 3 or 4 pages in that clip. And I know I probably glossed over a lot of things just because it's not that it doesn't stand out. It's just that there's just too much to go through here.
There's a lot.
Yeah, there is. And, I just wanted to kind of, because having a dialogue with somebody else, I mean, I can't, well, hey, GR, what does this mean? Oh, well, let me explain this. It just doesn't sound like discourse, if you understand what I'm saying. So let me have it. Where do we really want to start off?
Okay. So we had... Hang on a minute. I'm scrolling back.
So we left off with 39. We were starting off with paragraph 40.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. And so...
Anything that kind of jumps out of 40?
Yeah, 40. I think 40. I don't remember if I did an extra highlight on this, but here's the first line. The true question, therefore, is whether there be a constitutional right in a single state to nullify the law of the U.S. So Madison is addressing this very question.
Right. Yeah. So actually, he's re-emphasizing this question because we're at paragraph 40. He's brought up and commented that they can't do this. And so, again, he basically kind of is reiterating. The true question, therefore, is whether there be a constitutional right in a single state to nullify a law of the U.S., and then he goes on and says, we have seen the absurdity of such a claim in its simple, naked, and suicidal form. I mean, so in other words, he's just bringing it up again, and he's just saying, come on. This they're making it up as they go along. And then the other part of this that, I've highlighted that really, to me, I think is the most important part, because South Carolina basically made a direct tie to a constitutional convention. In other words, the process is, if we're really going to validate federal law, we have to have a constitutional convention to validate law.
Right. And that was going to be my next question. Didn't they have it backward?
Well, so actually the purpose of a constitutional convention is myopic. It is to consider changes to the Constitution, period. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not a mechanism to question laws.
Okay.
It's not a mechanism to say, well, we don't like this, so we're not going to enforce this. Any of you guys want to overpower us by using a convention?
So they are trying to twist it backwards.
Absolutely. This was such a perversion, and it was almost like, have you ever seen a kid? And I've seen when my kids would play with other kids, there'd always be a kid in the room, or outside in the park or what have you, that was so wild minded that they started concocting all of these weird rules to a simple hopscotch or something like that. And I'm going, I used to hate that. When I was a little kid, there'd be always this person that wanted to change the rules. And they would come up with these really elaborate excuses. And you could tell that they had tried it before, you know, so many times that they had actually developed those types of excuses.
Right.
And I'm going, so you, there's no doubt in my mind that John C. Calhoun and company in South Carolina had chewed on this and chewed on this, and they just, you know, worked it through this elaborate process of saying, well, we can get away with doing this and say that this is, you know, all, you know, this convention and all these things are, you know, basically tied to this. I mean, none of this was within the Constitution. And this is why Madison basically goes on and says, you know, well, actually, if you read in 41, I kind of got that highlighted. Every feature in the Constitution might thus be successfully changed if they go down this path and be able to do all of this. A scene of unexampled confusion and distraction. What had been unanimously agreed, in other words, the Constitution was ratified and unanimously agreed to as a whole, would not as a whole be agreed by a single state. The amount of this modified right of nullification is that a single state may arrest the operation of the law of the United States and institute a process which is to terminate the ascendancy of a minority over a large majority. In a republican system, the characteristic rule of which is that the major will is the prevailing ruling will.
Sure.
And so even though they did everything they could not to implement mob rule, it was a, you know, it was an organized mob rule. In other words, 3/4 of the state, you know, will be required to change the Constitution to give them a new power. If the federal government violates that, and the states choose to go along, it still doesn't make it constitutional. It just means that they're abiding by unconstitutional laws. And at any point, this comes right out of Madison's veto statement of the bonus bill. He says, even if the states agree, it still doesn't make it constitutional. At any point, they can pull the rug out from underneath you. Go get the amendment, because this is a really good idea.
Now, there's something else I notice here, and that is that he goes from here to claiming that the states are twisting Jefferson's words and blaming him for pushing nullification. Now, one of the things I want to point out is that this is like in the 1830s, near the end of Madison's life, so it's no longer a secret that Jefferson wrote the Kentucky Resolutions by this time.
That's right.
It was back then, okay, but it's not now. And so you know, looking back at history, you've apparently got the other states saying, hey, look at Jefferson's words. He said nullification was the right thing to do. And Madison is tearing that up.
Right. Absolutely. And so this is what he says right here, right after what I just read. And this newfangled theory is attempted to be fathered by or on Mr. Jefferson, the apostle of republicanism. Now, he didn't say the apostle of democracy, republicanism. Again, I go back and say, where is the evidence that they actually called themselves the Democratic Republicans? I mean, that just flies in the face of simplicity and being succinct. It is almost like doublespeak to say Democratic Republicans.
Right. It is.
Right? And so right. How
I've heard
is
that term before.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Wikipedia is filled with this crap. If you look at Wikipedia, they never refer to Jefferson and Madison's party as the Republican Party. It is the Democratic Republican Party. And there's no evidence that actually proves that that was founded. So we're going into a break here. And so this is why, you know, I even point to this document of how consistent Madison is in calling out the Republican Party as the party that him and Jefferson made. So when we come back, we'll try to push forward if Paul has some more questions and needs some more clarity before we move forward from where I left off. So folks, we'll be right back after this quick promo.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, as I was just kind of saying going into the promo, that you know, what else? So I'm sure that there's a lot, because I covered a lot of material, and I don't marginalize it. It's just that I've read it so many times, it kind of makes sense, but I still struggle. As a matter of fact, you know, you could tell that, you know, these acronyms and sometimes the double that's and those types of things just kind of hang me up. It's kind of hard to, you know, read through some of this stuff. So anyway, so that's 41, where they actually tried to, I'll just say, directly tie and tether Jefferson as the father of nullification. As a matter of fact, today I've met militia groups and all sorts of people that, and I see this all the time, and that's just because we've all been indoctrinated that Jefferson was the father of nullification, this concept of states just basically flat out denying and outright not following the constitutional, or I should say the laws that the federal government create that violate it, instead of actually holding the federal government, you know, accountable to the Constitution and getting them back into that framework.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I want to jump to 43 for a minute, because I think I asked you about this.
Uh-huh.
And that is, again, Madison's defending Jefferson, but then there's this line. It says, they seize on an expression of Mr. Jefferson that nullification is the rightful remedy as the shibboleth of their party and almost a sanctification of their cause. G.R., I'm used to reading this kind of language, but I don't know what they mean by this.
Okay,
maybe
so
it's something we can cover later. But
it's a Hebrew term. I thought it was referring to sacred, like the Sabbath or something like that, because the Shabbat is the Sabbath. And so after, you know, looking at it after yesterday, basically shibboleth. Is a custom or tradition, usually a choice of phrasing or even a single word that distinguishes one group of people from another. And here's the interesting thing, here's the irony, that when you look at its application, I was looking through Wikipedia, and they talked about in Judges, in the Old Testament, in Judges, there was this part where, and the Galadites, or whatever they're called, took the passage of Jordan from the Ephraimites. And it was so that when the Ephraimites, which were escaped, said, let me go over, that the men of Gilead said unto them, art thou an Ephraimite? And if they said nay, then they would say unto him, say now shibboleth. And he said Sibboleth. In other words, it wasn't Sibboleth, it was Sibboleth. They dropped the H, for he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passages of Jordan. In other words, this word actually became a test of differentiating between whether somebody was truly an Ephraimite or not.
Interesting. So the Ephraimites were unable to phrase this word.
Yes. The way they spelt it and said it was S-I-B-B-O-L-E-T-H. And with the Jews and the rest of, I guess, the world, they shib with an S-H-I.
Okay.
They couldn't do the sh. And sib, they did sib. And so it was this test. It almost like how the Romans tested the Christians, you know, whether they were Christian or not. And the way Christians actually identified each other with the fish, you know, it wasn't uncommon that they had to create secrecy amongst themselves so that they, you know, wouldn't perish, so that they could continue doing what they were doing.
One more line.
I'm glad you brought it up because I did gloss over that, and it was one of those things. That, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so in the next one, and then here's Jefferson driving this point home. But in addition to, what's this YR, into their inconsistency, their zeal is guilty of the subterfuge of dropping a part of the language of Mr. Jefferson, which shows his meaning to be entirely at variance with the nullifying construction. So in other words, he's saying they know what they're doing. They're using some of Jefferson's words and dropping out the context. Okay, and like you just said, it's happening even today because of that. So it's really important for us. You know, we need to dig deeper than we do, and we live in a headline culture. Where people will read a headline, and they won't read any deeper. It's a conditioning GR.
No, it's the same thing with scriptures, though. You know, many times people will find a word within a passage of scripture that really states what they want, but if you read the whole scripture and place context to what that little line or phrase is, it doesn't take the same meaning. In other words, you know, and I remember this, there was a church, and this was in the 80s, early 80s, that there was a Christian church that was based on homosexuality, and they claimed to be Christian because, you know, Christ said, love thy brother. And so, in other words, they just took that line and they completely perverted it by just saying, well, you know, we're not going to read the rest of the scripture. We're just love thy brother.
Wow. That's way out of...
There are people that will, and rightfully so or wrongfully so, there are people that will go out of their way and they'll go to the extreme in trying to, you know, meet their ends. In other words, it's kind of like the ends justify the means. You know, well, I'm against killing people, but... you know, there's no way we can save you, so we have to kill you. It's like this real extreme that completely creates a conflict with what they're saying, and it doesn't matter because the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I hear you. So he goes on, and then let's see. It cannot be supposed for a moment that Mr. Jefferson would not revolt at the doctrine of South Carolina, that a single state could constitutionally resist a law of the Union whilst remaining in it. So, you know, Madison is just doubling down on this, okay?
Yeah.
And let's see, in which he makes a rightful remedy of the state in an extreme case would be separation from the Union, not a resistance to its authority while remaining in it.
Right.
He takes... you know, Madison and Jefferson were close, by the way, and so he really takes almost to a point of he's irritated.
Right, right. Yeah. And Monroe actually was close to all three of them. As a matter of fact, Monroe was a friend of Jefferson's, and Jefferson introduced Monroe and him. But Jefferson and Madison were far closer than, you know, anybody else. And I can't imagine how Madison, you know, as far as a brother, you know, in the cause, was, you know, his closest brother was Jefferson.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
So let's see. At 46, let's see. There was something here. Excuse me, you know, what?
Okay.
This may have occurred in urgent cases. So another highlight here, one thing seems to be certain, that the states which have exposed themselves to the charge of nullification have, with the exception of South Carolina, disclaimed it as a constitutional right. So what is he saying here, that the other states recognize this, and South Carolina is the bad boy, or what?
So, yeah, in other words, no other state is agreeing with South Carolina.
Okay.
In other words, they've disclaimed it as a constitutional right. I mean, everybody kind of agrees, you know, there is this right of nullification, but no one agrees with the way South Carolina is defining it.
Okay.
Okay. But here's the thing. At this point in time, in 1834, South Carolina against the world, with this perversion of this process of standing up against the Union. Mm-hmm. And so everybody so here's the question. How is it that the wrong prevailing idea has now become the prevailing idea as the only doctrine?
Well, that's a good question. How is that?
Well, it becomes the most convenient thing. And as a matter of fact, I would just say the evil one, Satan or what have you, and it's easy just to point and throw this, you know, judgment of evil upon this. But, you know, clearly Madison was looking at it this way. And the way he was going after these guys, you could clearly see that I don't want to say he was possessed. He was actually trying to exercise this. And, you know,
exercise, as in an exorcist.
As in an exorcism, yes, correct. And so, you know, if you really look at how far he's going here, this is almost like an exorcism. Mm-hmm. And so as we look at how this idea perpetuated through time, you know, bad ideas always grow legs. And bad ideas all of a sudden get embraced when you don't have the full story. It's almost like that little kid that perverted one game into being something else. And it's all a completely different game altogether. And that's exactly what ended up coming out of South Carolina. Because, I mean, look at all the institutions that are even calling for this. You know, I hate to mention the Eagles Forum, but they're actually supporting nullification. You know, they would rather see nullification than a convention of states. And as I said yesterday, and I really mean this, folks, that even though the convention at this point in time, because of the illiteracy and because the lunacy of those who are seeking an Article 5 convention, because there is nothing they've put on the table that would actually help. What they have put on the table, almost every single one of their amendments, will actually validate and create a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. So there's no time and there's no resources worth committing to a convention, and it would be disastrous.
Right.
But as I said yesterday, that there is never a time, period. There's not even an appropriate time, even with the planets aligning, where single state nullification will work.
Wow.
Does that make sense now?
it would turn the nation into chaos.
Right, absolutely, as all of the states basically abandoned their obligation in maintaining unity within the union.
Sure.
And as the kids run around and get their cheese and candy and whatever they have the compulsion or, you know, this desire to do, you know, in other words, it's just like chasing your lusts. Oh, well, we don't like this law. We're not going to follow that. We want to do this. We're going to continue to do this instead of that.
So here's something that comes to mind. I don't remember if you brought this up in one of your shows or if it was just one of our discussions. But several years ago, there were a majority of the states that objected to Obamacare. Remember this?
Yeah, 29 states total. Yeah,
29 states. You realize that had 29 states used the Republic review process, we would not have Obamacare.
That is correct. That is correct, yes.
But what
would have happened, just so you understand this, what would have happened, because, see, Obamacare was passed when? 2012?
Was it that? Let's see. I was still in. It may have been. I can look it up.
Okay. So it's my contention that Obamacare, because there were so many states that were against it, they were tied to, and the majority of all of these people, or I should say the majority of the leaders in the states that were standing up against it, were lawyers. And their inclination is we got to keep it in the money mill. In other
2010.
Words, 2010. Okay. So it wasn't, when did it go into the lawsuit? I think it was in 2012 when Justice Roberts, basically they finally had their ruling, because it took a while for all of the states to stir up. I think it was 2012 when the Supreme Court actually made their ruling.
Let's see. The Supreme Court, wait a minute. Supreme Court decision on Obamacare was.
I think you'll find
this can't be.
Go ahead.
This can't be right. This says ACA survives, Affordable Care Act survives a legal challenge. Supreme Court ruled in June 2021.
I think there was another challenge to it, but the initial challenge where Roberts made this imbecilic assertion that Obamacare was a tax and therefore it was legitimate.
Right.
No, it wasn't a tax. It basically was a subscription that everybody had to basically go and have insurance. And if you didn't, they would then hit you with a fee and penalty.
Correct.
And then he says, well, this was a tax. If that was the case, then they wouldn't have been able to regulate and seize control. It would just say, okay, if you don't have a national health care, then we're just going to tax you. But that didn't give them the right to regulate and create all of these, you know, to force this consolidation and everything else that was a part of the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it would have been only one page of, okay, you know, we've created a mandate that we're going to tax everybody that doesn't have insurance. That's not what they did. In other words, it wasn't a tax. It was an associated fee to regulations that they started creating that they had no enumerated power to be involved in.
Correct.
And so Robert should have just challenged the fact that you can't even, you know, create this association of a fee or tax because you don't have the enumerated power to even regulate this stuff, to even mandate it.
Well,
and so Roberts, I mean, this guy committed treason.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the only justice, but because it was his opinion and it was his tie-breaking vote.
Right. So here we have, but what we had, I guess the point I wanted to make was we had so many states that we had enough states to have put Obamacare in the grave, okay, with the right process.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and now there are other issues that, you know, attorney generals from several states are getting together and saying, we don't like this. Our states don't like this.
Uh-huh.
But it's the wrong direction, GR. It's right. The courts.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Okay. And in fact, just above, I think I passed over it, but just above here somewhere, you know, Madison points out that the Supreme Court isn't the final arbiter of what's right in the Constitution.
Yes, yes.
I actually skipped over. I don't. You might remember what paragraph it is, but I think we passed it already.
Yeah, we did. We already covered that. And yeah. Well, actually, look at 46.
Okay, let me see. 46. It is said. There we go. There we go. I'm passing off. It is said several instances successfully nullified
as a lesser evil than a resort to force, or in cases not falling within the federal jurisdiction, or finally in cases deemed by the states subversive of their essential rights and justified thereby the natural right law of self-preservation. Be all of these. So he points out that the federal government and the construction of the federal government, that, you know, they, you know, have this power or jurisdiction. But what you're really talking about, I think it's in 47, but the final acquiescence of the state in the authority of the federal judiciary transfers the authority to the other scale, and it is believed that the opinions of the two judges have been superseded by those of their brethren, which have since been and at the present time are opposed to them. So, yeah. I mean, he brings this up, and then later on he even talks more about the, you know, I'll just say the jurisdiction and so forth with the Alien Sedition Acts. But it's in the best clarity regarding the judiciary not having the ability to be involved in violations of the Constitution is in Madison's report on the Virginia Resolutions of 1800. That's where we really read that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. So let's see, where are we now? 46, 47. We looked at, yeah, we went through 49, right?
Yep. Well, okay. No, we haven't gone through 49 yet.
Oh, we
as
haven't,
far as you haven't asked any questions, I mean,
no, it was 49 highlighted again. It's sometimes asked in what mode the states could interpose in their collective character as parties to the Constitution against usurped power. It was not necessary for the object and reasoning of the resolutions and report that the mode should be pointed out. Okay,
yeah.
So, here is what I was looking for.
So, but what he's really pointing out there is that it is sometimes asked in what mode the states could interpose in their collective characters, parties to the Constitution, against a usurped power.
This is the paragraph I was looking for.
Okay.
About the courts, because it says it was sufficient to show that the authority to interpose existed and was a resort beyond that of the Supreme Court of the U.S.
Uh-huh.
Or any authority derived from the Constitution.
Right.
Authority being plenary.
Yes.
The mode was of its own choice, and it is obvious that if employed by the states as co-parties to the creators of the Constitution, it might either so explain the Constitution or so amend it as to provide a more satisfactory mode within the Constitution itself for guarding it against constructive or other violations. That's the paragraph I was looking for.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Plenary.
Because he makes it clear that the states as parties to the Constitution are superior to the Supreme Court.
That is right. That okay. is correct, because the parties being the creator of the Supreme Court must there go. I mean, the creator of the universe must have a much greater sovereignty than its creation.
Correct.
Right.
All right. And we have. And so what's happened is, you know, these states get together, and the thing has been turned on its head, because I haven't heard a single one of them stand up and say, hey, we're in charge, okay? Not a single attorney general. It's all like we're appealing to – it's almost as if they think they're appealing to a higher power. They are not.
Right.
But states united – are the higher power. You know, Article 7, the parties to the contract, they are the higher power.
Right, right. Now, okay. In 56, it's a very short paragraph or a very short, concise sentence where he says, it appears still further that the efficacious interposition contemplated by the legislature, Virginia and Kentucky, was a concurring and cooperating interposition of the states, not that of a single state.
I like that one. I'm highlighting that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. All right. So let's see. We're constitutionally different in different states, I think.
Okay, so that right there is just jumping out. And I've said this before, that the federal government cannot treat one state differently than another. In other words, the federal government can't come in and seize your forest and not do that to everybody else. As a matter of fact, I really was mowing on this and, you know, ruminating on, you know, what is the average government? If we go through every state and we define all of the unconstitutional land that the federal government has grabbed, like 90% of Nevada, you know, probably 80% of California. And what I want to do is put this in a spreadsheet because bottom line, there is an argument that says that there must be at least a median, if not an average, that every state must surrender to the federal government this unconstitutional grab of land. Because the fact is, the Western states are bearing a burden that the Eastern states or the rest of the states are not.
I've got a map, GR. It's amazing.
Yeah. So send me that map. I'm going to put it in a spreadsheet, and I'll bring it up tomorrow for our show. Because what I'll do is I'll be able to come up with what the percentages, because I want to play with percentages. What is the average percentage? Because when you have half the states that have such a high propensity, we may actually have a national average requirement that every state must surrender 25% of their state to the federal government, you know, for tyranny.
Well, that's not in the Constitution.
No, it's not. But this, what is he saying here? He's saying it appears that the object to be obtained by the invited cooperation with Virginia was, as expressed in the third and second, or the seventh resolution, to maintain within their several states their respective authorities, rights, and liberties, which could not be constitutionally different in different states. So in other words, if, you know, one state is going to go and, you know, be punished, then they all have to be equally punished. The federal government cannot treat one state different than another state. And the reason why the Western states were, you know, basically, you know, fed to the wolves was because all of the Eastern states said, well, you know, it's not like they'll ever have this big control in Congress to take back that land.
Mm.
And so they were okay with it because bottom line, every time the Fed, so, you know, when you look at the money game, right, of government, every state that joined the union actually bolstered the financial well-being of the union, because when a territory existed, it could not be apportioned for taxation. So, folks, Paul, we'll have to bring this back up tomorrow. We just ran out of time. So I'll highlight this because the apportionment and taxation and the financial well-being of the union, I think, is, you know, worth the dialogue. And so I really appreciate having you back because it forces these discussions. Folks, as we peel through this, you'll realize that we are Reclaiming the Republic, and we do need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.